projection to do it.
What does literature sound like? What stories will we hear if we listen to the archive? Welcome to the Spoken Web Podcast, stories about how literature sounds. My name is Hannah McGregor, and each month I'll be bringing you different stories of Canadian literary history and our contemporary responses to it, created by scholars, poets, students, and artists from across Canada. On the Spoken Web Podcast, we talk a lot about different ways that sound and literature collide, whether that collision takes place in the Spoken Web archives or through research symposiums, poetry readings, and literary events. While past episodes have brought us into the university setting through interviews with professors and explorations of student work in the Spoken Web network, we have yet to really explore how sound and literature collide in the classroom. Whether that's high school, university, or elsewhere, what are the different ways that sound is being taken up as a learning tool in the literary community? We could even say we're in a classroom of sorts together, here and now, listening and learning in dialogue through the Spoken Web Podcast. Ah, and it sounds like class is about to begin. In this episode, we join director of the Spoken Web Network and professor at Concordia University, Jason Camelot, in conversation with Spoken Web Podcast supervising producer and Simon Fraser University PhD candidate Stacey Copeland in exploring sound and listening in the literary classroom. Together, we'll listen back to select cylinder talks created by Concordia graduate students and unpack the experiences, ideas, and discussions sparked by the production and study of sound across disciplines. A 3-minute audio project assigned to students in Jason's graduate course, Literary Listening as Cultural Technique, the Cylinder Talk draws on a rich history of early spoken sound recordings, inviting us into an embodied sonic engagement with the study of literature. Here are Stacey Copeland and Jason Camelot with Cylinder Talks, Pedagogy in Literary Sound Studies.
Hey, Stacey.
Hello, how are you?
Good. Sorry about that. I was in the wrong room.
I mean, that's what happens when we have probably 5 or 6 different links we've used now for exactly. The podcast. All right, you want to get started?
Let's go for it.
Podcast project manager Stacey Copeland here. I'm joined in our podcast classroom of sorts, aka Zoom video room, by Jason Camelot, director of the Spoken Web Research Network, and likely a familiar voice if you've listened to season 1 of the podcast. So being a student myself, teacher, a sound scholar, I'm quite interested in the different ways that audio media production is being taken up as a learning tool across different disciplines. Whether that's a project like Spoken Web, or I think might be the case with the audio we'll be listening to today, audio assignments that take students out of the traditional essay writing headspace and into a different mode of engaging with ideas in the classroom. But rather than me guessing at the inner workings of your graduate course, Jason, you've brought a selection of student assignments for us to listen to together. Why don't you tell us a bit more about the course, the assignments, and what we'll be hearing today?
Okay. Well, thanks, Stacey, very much. I'm entering our Spoken Web Zoom classroom, as you describe it, both as a student and as someone who just taught a grad seminar called Literary Listening as Cultural Technique. I should say I've been trying to teach with sound in my literature courses for about a decade now, with varying degrees of success. You know, I think the first few times that I taught sound recordings of literary performances in a classroom, I just played them and then expected something to happen. And nothing happened because I found that the students and myself as well, like we weren't equipped to actually engage critically with those kinds of materials. And so I called this course Literary Listening, and literary is in parentheses. So it's a very typographical title, I suppose. Literary is really cordoned off from listening as cultural technique. And most of the seminar, we're reading theories of listening from disciplines that are not literary. As far as the assignments for the entire seminar were really leading towards a final paper. And then there was this assignment that we're talking about, which I called it the cylinder talk, right? And I've done this before. And the cylinder talk, the title, really comes from my own research fairly extensively in early spoken sound recordings and thinking about the implications of media formats in relation to what I would identify as literary forms, right? So how do the constraints of a particular format inform what one can do in terms of delivering a story or a poem or an argument of some kind? Because cylinders, you know, back in the day, but in the acoustic period of sound recording, sort of pre-1920, and usually much earlier than that, so from the 1890s on, generally held between 2 and 4 minutes of sound. The cylinder represents a time constraint as a result of sort of preservation surface. So it's using a material artifact on which sound was first recorded as a temporal constraint to begin with for an assignment. For the courses where I was doing these cylinder talks, they knew what a cylinder was and understood what the implications were because we'd studied them. So we'd listened to cylinder recordings, right? You know, we'd studied sort of late Victorian, early sound recordings where full Victorian novels were compressed into the time frame of a 3-minute cylinder. You know, how do you deliver David Copperfield in 3 minutes?
Ah, my dear Copperfield.
Early cylinder remediations of fiction mainly focused on either character sketches. That's one way in which you compress a 400-page novel into 3 minutes. Or they would focus on key transformation scenes like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
The fiend is coming, yes. Hyde is here. The noise offends the ear.
Or the mesmerism scene from George du Maurier's novel Trilby, where Svengali is mesmerizing Trilby.
And shall see nothing, hear nothing, think nothing, but Svengali, Svengali.
Or in A Christmas Carol, when Ebenezer Scrooge is transformed from a Scroogey Scrooge into a benevolent, generous person.
Here's a God-sent dream to save me from myself. May God and this merry Christmas time be thanked for the reformation that shall now begin with Ebenezer.
Yeah, so the fiction cylinder, that's the way they got around the question of constraint and compression. In this seminar, I wanted to have the students engage in a sort of, not a super demanding way, but just to have the experience of working with the digital audio workstation, even if it means just having sort of 2 tracks and having to edit, select, engage with digitized sound, to think about both the media through which we were encountering all of the sounds in the course. And I also wanted them to experience the kind of intensity that audio editing entails. Having to engage in that activity, I felt, represents a way of thinking about methodology, so that it's sort of a form of listening that to some extent estranges you from the listening because you may not know how to use the tools that well, so it's not so natural to use them. It's a nice extension of the longer sort of theoretical discussions we've been having throughout the semester about listening as a kind of audile technique or as a cultural technique. So it required them to produce a sound work. So that was sort of one of the goals. And the other constraints, apart from time alone, was they had to present a main idea, argument, or concept that they were going to explore in the paper that they were writing. And they had to integrate at least one sound from the area that they were exploring. And I did imagine this not only as a kind of production-oriented assignment, but I knew we were going to have a listening session, listening party of sorts, in our very last class, where everyone would get to hear everyone else's cylinder talks, but also engage in responding to what they heard.
You've brought in 4 talks from the course for us to listen to today, which will give everyone a bit more of a sense of what the students ended up with after engaging in this cylinder talk format. We're going to play the full talk, which of course is only 3 minutes. It's not too long for each one. And then we've chosen a bit of discussion to illustrate some of the critical thought that came after that listening experience together.
Yeah, as we were listening, of course, we were on Zoom. So a bunch of squares showing everyone's faces, everyone's video was on. And that was one of the most enjoyable and interesting elements of the several hours that we spent listening together was just watching everyone's reactions. This was the first time that everyone got to share something they'd made in this way. And so that was, I think, a really special aspect of this last listening session that we did together. So which is the first one we're going to listen to?
I think the first one I have queued up is Alexandra's talk.
So Alexandra Swinney was thinking about and reading about environmental soundscape production. I think Alexandra, who is really working on Canadian poetry, so this is not necessarily, you know, in her wheelhouse, really just became excited about some of the articles that were about environmental sound, and she pursued that topic.
Alexandra's talk, Ethics of Field Recording in Irv Teibel's Environment Series.
Yes.
So let's take a listen.
White noise to me has always sounded like falling snow. When I was little, waking up after a VHS always felt like falling asleep and waking up in the middle of a snowstorm. I picture static like a blizzard that surrounds and disorients you. Every sound we hear exists on a spectrum, analogous to colors. White noise, like snowfall, has a wide frequency spectrum, and clearer tones a narrow one. According to bioacoustician Bernie Krause, in a healthy ecosystem, in a healthy soundscape, the sound spectrum is full, with living creatures filling every frequency band. In altered and recently developed landscapes, such as clear-cut forests or logging paths, the sound spectrum has notable gaps. White noise helps you forget about all that. Snowfall is an ambient sound, and it blankets what it covers audibly just as it does visually. Snow absorbs noise, and it isolates and insulates. I use recordings of snowfall to study, read, and write. In a library, snowfall through my headphones would dull the sounds of rattling coffee cups and scraping chairs. It began when I encountered Irv Teibel's Environment Series, a set of 11 long-playing records created in the 60s and 70s. Alpine Blizzard is the title of the A-side on the last record. I could imagine myself isolated, as if on top of a mountain, piling text on a page while the snow piled high around me. But this isn't how the sounds were recorded. Rather than setting atop a prime peak and letting the natural world do the work, colleagues of Teibel's recall how he viewed nature as an obstacle to be tackled, wrestled, and refined. Rather than any old beach sound, for instance, he wanted the perfect beach sound, a track he eventually mixed with samples across 12 different locations, which were ultimately processed using localizers and equalizers, the sounds broken down into new recombinations and new synthetic waves to cover the splices. The result was his first track, Environments One, Psychologically Ultimate Seashore. In my essay, I want to contend with the ethics of Teibel's Environment Series, which are among the first and most contentious field recording compositions to be sold in mainstream markets. I ask, what are the risks of psychologically ultimate sound and field recordings, which are designed to soothe and calm, but which distance us from the psychologically and acoustically disruptive noises of anthropocentric contact and occupation? How do these ambient and curated soundscapes, made for the human, but without the human, frame our relationship to the landscape, both imaginary and real? What are we to make of soundscapes that allow us to forget our place in the world, rather than which remind us of it?
Great job, Alexandra. Any first thoughts for us on it?
Yeah, I guess I got on thinking about it from one of this additional readings on the bibliography of listening that talked about other field and sound recordings that have come up in the past years and just how the composer's stance to the original recordings have changed. I think the article was talking about Derek Chark's Falling from Cloudless Skies, which recorded the sounds of glaciers cleaving and melting. And then Songs of the Humpback Whale also mentioned that article. So I was just thinking about how field recordings have changed to reflect the attitudes that we're having towards the natural world since the 60s.
Michael?
I thought that the thing was like, in some ways, like very objectively beautiful, because you have this white noise. And then the idea is that all of these, not only these ideas that you're talking about are like being evoked out of the white noise, but you also do this really, I guess this is what meditation tapes in general do, is that they have white noise and then they have people evoking landscapes out of them that you're supposed to visualize. But here you actually told us that they were coming out of the white noise itself, which is really interesting. It literalized the trick that I think that those that meditation tapes usually use.
That was my menaces.
Thank you. Yeah, meditation tapes, like just even as a whole, like would be a really good example of this, that are just like designed to put you to sleep and really zone out. I have listened to those also in the past.
Yeah, Andrew Whiteman.
On that, what I was thinking what you were doing is you have sound behind you and then it fades out and then you bring the sound back again. And I thought you were tricking it. I thought you were playing us something from the LP series you were talking about. And then I thought you were fading an actual white noise, because I find a lot of sort of new laptop-based composers are trying to make fake natural sounds using the sounds that are only available inside a digital audio workstation, playing with the nature culture thing there.
Yeah, and no, that was just a recording on my Fire Escape with the bells that came in right at the end, and I figured I would put them in because those very much, they take me out of whatever I'm doing and remind me like exactly what time it is and where I am, so...
Yeah, just to build on everything that everyone's been saying, I thought it was a wonderful example of a kind of anti-meditation tape, or a meditation tape that makes you reflect on, you know, all the ethical issues surrounding, you know, what meditation tapes are trying to do, perhaps. But also, I thought rhetorically, the way you brought us into the description of what a natural soundscape and its sort of diverse frequency spectrum, you know, would normally entail, going to the silence that mimetically performs that. And then when you say white noise makes us forget about all that, rhetorically, that whole sequence was really, really effective and powerful, because you brought us into like, oh, okay, we're going to hear this sound over and over again, but we're not going to hear it the same way because you're teaching us how to hear it differently and sort of the implications of what we're hearing.
The images you actually evoke are not, like, you start by saying that they're these beautiful natural landscapes, but then the white noise is something that is blocking out global catastrophe of like glaciers splitting off from mountains. And like, I don't know, the songs of humpback whales was also a very good image.
So I never thought I would hear a student referencing Bernie Krause in a literature course, but there we go. So what is it like listening back to this discussion for you, Jason?
Brought me right back into the moment of sort of the excitement immediately after hearing the piece for the first time. I really did think that Alexandra's cylinder, more than others, had a kind of almost ASMR quality to it. You know, really, it was very tactile. And also the way she delivered her text was really interesting, because she allowed for a lot of space in between sentences. It almost sounded like a poem. So I think I was hearing a little bit more the form of the piece, even more than I had, you know, the first time. Her selection of sounds really did get to the core of some of the ethical issues that she was interested in exploring.
Yeah, I mean, before the discussion came in, my mind was already churning all around all the possibilities of what you might have been listening to in the course, because that sort of close recording, that very ASMR tactile quality that the white noise track has in Alexandra's piece really reminded me of Hildegard Westerkamp's work.
These are the tiny, the intimate voices of nature, of bodies, of dreams, of the imagination.
Particularly her Kitts Beach piece, which does also have a very poetic flow in the vocal performance, and then the very close recording and very tactile sensation of listening to the barnacles on Kitts Beach in Vancouver.
You're still hearing the barnacle sounds, and already they're changing.
And this recording brought me right back there. So then I was so surprised to hear in the discussion that Alexandra just recorded this on her Fire Escape. And then also the bells, because then I was thinking, well, if you were listening to R. Murray Schafer, maybe the bells were intentional and kind of an ode to 1970s acoustic ecology. But no, it was just her everyday experience.
There was a longer discussion about the bells afterward, because we talked about bells an awful lot in our seminar from Schafer, but also because one of the earliest sort of documentary recordings was of Big Ben tolling. London in 1890. So we talked about what what that meant, you know, what it means to record a bell, what a bell is, especially a publicly heard bell as a means of something that many people in an area can hear, how the bell measures time, you know, et cetera, you know. So yeah, we thought about bells a lot, and yet there they are, right? You know, just in her neighborhood ringing, and she integrated them. We really didn't do much listening to soundscape recordings in the seminar. The majority of the recordings we listened to were still voice-based in one way or another, even though they may have been quite experimental. But that was all Alexandra following her interest and discovering sounds.
I love this first example because it really illustrates some of the ways that thinking through sound studies, regardless of whether you've listened to specific acoustic ecologists or sound recordists like Hildegard Westerkamp, and thinking about the World Soundscape Project, and you had a bit of introduction in the course for students around R. Murray Schafer and around soundscape and those ideas.
We are the composers of this huge, miraculous composition that's going on around us, and we can improve it or we can destroy it. We can add more noises or we can add more beautiful sounds. It's all up to us.
Thinking about how reading those ideas can then lead to very similar sonic aesthetics in this particular cylinder talk, it'd be interesting to see how that translates across different disciplines as well.
Yeah, I think that's such a great question. And coming from literature, one of the challenges is to move away from the semantic signal when you're listening to voice recordings. Alexandra's sort of interest in moving away from sounds with semantic meaning, like, you know, was a fulfillment of what we were often trying but failing to do in listening to some of the literary recordings. Another thing that I think I heard in the responses to Alexandra's was a real interest in trying to identify what Michel Chion would call causal listening. I thought you were making the sounds do with this, but actually it turned out to be that, you know, and that also was an ongoing sort of frame for our course, you know, thinking about what it means to identify sound as objects, you know, or with particular sources.
We kind of see some similar overlaps in these ideas of sonic environment and our relationship to the soundscape and the way that these kind of core ideas that come out of cultural sound studies have been taken up by your students through this literature course. And we hear these themes come up again in the next cylinder talk that you've chosen for us.
Okay, so this is Sarah Adams. This is probably in some ways the most challenging of the projects because most of the sounds that she wants to write about can never be heard again. Her world is set in the 1840s in Victorian London. Sarah is a PhD student, and she's a 19th century scholar. I'm a Victorianist, first and foremost, I suppose, still. And so she's come to work on Henry Mayhew, who is a journalist, also an early ethnographer, oral historian, data collector about, I guess, marginal peoples living in urban environments in the 19th century. His best-known work is called London Labor and the London Poor, which is a remarkable, extensive, and expansive document of interviews with people who are living and working in London, but not necessarily in recognized jobs or positions. So many of them are doing the work in the city that is rendered invisible to anyone above the lower middle classes, the street sweepers, the garbage collectors, people who are selling wares in the street. A very famous figure from Mayhew that gets anthologized for some reason, the Watercress Girl, you know, is the one that gets repeated and anthologized a lot. Mayhew, half of his work or more than half of his work are actual transcriptions of interviews that he held. He writes them in the voices of the people he interviewed. We don't know how accurate, and there's obviously been a lot of sort of critique of sort of him as a mediator of these voices. So those are sounds that Sarah was very interested in exploring as sounds. So I don't think she had thought of them as sounds previously. That informed her new investigation for her, I think, and for me, because I hadn't thought about Mayhew this way either, thinking about where different people who make certain sounds as a result of the labor they pursue, whether they're perceived as noise or as a kind of meaningful signal in certain ways.
Great. Well, let's take a listen.
Over the course of the 19th century, Victorian London experienced an unprecedented growth in population size. Consequently, Britain's largest city was not only choked with dirt and dust, but it was also overwhelmingly, quote, alive with sound, unquote. In the city's street markets, butchers, fishmongers, and other street sellers shouted over each other, trying to catch the attention of passers-by. the raucous symphony of London's streets was also filled with bamboo flute players, organ grinders, and other street musicians, as well as the clomping of horses' hooves, the clattering of carriages and carts, and the distant roar of the new railway. It was truly an, quote, age of osculation, unquote, as John Picker argues, full of careful and close listening to a noisy and rapidly changing modern world. While some 19th century writers and intellectuals tried to escape from the piercing sounds of the city streets, the journalist Henry Mayhew embraced them, diving headfirst into London's East End and interviewing street vendors and other impoverished street folk in order to compile an encyclopedic archive entitled London Labour and the London Poor, first published in 1851. London Labour was ultimately an unfinished, multi-volume work that recorded the everyday living and working conditions of London's marginalized urban poor. Mayhew was explicitly interested in reproducing, in print form, the real and, quote, unvarnished, unquote, voices of London street folk, unquote, from the lips of the people themselves, unquote. By deploying carefully detailed and mimetic description while also striving to transcribe his subject's interview answers verbatim, Mayhew attempted to create a literary work that faithfully sounded and resounded like a phonograph. Not only did Mayhew seek to bear witness to and preserve the voices of a rapidly disappearing population, but his project also simultaneously pushed the boundaries of what print could do. In my paper, I will explore how Mayhew uses sound to immerse his middle-class audience in the urban underworld of outcast London. How does Mayhew's use of sound in the text create the conditions of possibility for hearing? What kind of ear witnessing does Mayhew perform in the text? And what novel aesthetic, ethical, or political realities does this osculative work make possible? I find it fascinating that Mayhew's text reverberates not only with the sights of the city, but also equally with its sounds, creating an immersive reading experience that grounds its reader firmly in a stable spatial and temporal setting. Mayhew's text is also striking because it not only records the everyday noises of the city's quotidian hustle and bustle, but it also trains its ear, and by extension, its reader's ear, on individuals and their personal stories of loss, struggle, and small moments of joy. In this way, Mayhew conditions his readers to differentiate sound from noise, listening from hearing, a sonic and sympathetic movement with profound ethical and political possibilities.
Thanks, guys. I guess I'm always interested in, like, what does it mean to listen? What does it mean to hear? What conditions, specifically political, arise out of certain kinds of listening? And also, what do they not make possible, or what does incomplete listening or partial or warped, I mean, it's always mediated through all sorts of things. And I think in those clips there, like, there's so many different levels of my mediation and, like, interpretation, but then also Mayhew, like, trying to get towards, like, an authentic kind of unvarnished, untouched idea of someone's sound and someone's story. But we just know that's not possible, right? We know that that mediation fundamentally does distort, and that there are, you know, implications for that.
I'm not too familiar with Henry Mayhew.
Aubrey Grant.
But I know that, like, within that context of the different social reformers at that period, there was a lot of talk of, like, questions of, like, sanitation and cleanliness, the dangers that the poor sort of, like, brought onto society in terms of illness, in terms of also, like smells as well and all this stuff. But thinking about it in terms of noise, I was wondering if there was, like, a connection between a kind of discourse of sanitation and a discourse of noise.
Yeah, I guess for both, I was sort of connecting them. And actually, I've done a lot of work on waste and sanitation during this period. So that's why I was sort of like, oh, I never thought of the sonic, like, qualities. And I've thought of, like, material pollution in the terms of, like, dirt and dust and human waste, decaying white matter, whatever, but not in terms of noise pollution. A lot of those people and places have been extinguished and have been made obsolete by industry and by industrial processes and by modernity. And that's actually a really big part of Mayhew's project, was actually to record these people's voices and their everyday lives and the details about their mundane toings and froings, because they all like disappeared basically slowly. Like police were more, there was more police around. So there was more policing of like the city and making people move around more and not letting them just sell wherever. There were more laws about street music and who could play where. You know, we have that today still with like red zoning, people who are on the sides, on the streets, like asking for money, policing the poor in all sorts of ways.
Is sound in any of his tables? I don't recall.
Yeah, so they're not. The closest would be like he talks about how many carriages are on the road, how many more carriages there are now than there were before. Like for me, it feels like he's kind of putting that osculation, like that idea of like the stethoscope, he's sort of applying it to the body politic, or at least a very small part of it, of the urban poor in London, taking its heartbeat.
I just called up because you were talking about it, sort of one of my favorite methods of categorization that Mayhew uses of the population, right? And it could be interesting to think about what sounds did these four sectors of the population create, or do they tend to create, right? He calls them the enrichers, the auxiliaries, the benefactors, and the servitors. And the thing about Mayhew that's so cool, right, is that it's very leveling, these categories. It's based on your instrumental contribution rather than your social status. Servitors are the actors, the servants, all of the London poor that you're talking about, like the street sweepers and scavengers, but the Queen is considered a servitor as well, and members of Parliament. To think about sonic emanations according to some of these attempts at categorizing populations and the spaces they use, obviously, because space, and going back to Aubrey's point, thinking maybe sound is more important to me. I'm really excited to look back and think about the status of sound in relation to the other senses in Mayhew.
It's great. Listening back to this discussion, you can really hear how excited you are about this topic.
Yeah, well, it reintroduced Mayhew to me in a whole new way. So I was super excited about where Sarah was going with her work. And there's been some excellent sort of sound studies oriented work in Victorian studies. She mentions John Picker, and John Picker's book, Victorian Soundscapes, does a lot of excellent sort of analysis of noise pollution in the Victorian period and how it relates to identity formation and different sort of, and especially the bourgeois subject. But I don't think he talks about Mayhew, and I hadn't thought about Mayhew. And it's in so many ways such an obvious text to think about from a sonic perspective.
Yeah. And I mean, in this discussion, I mean, this is just like a little slice of the very in-depth discussion that the students were having after listening to Sarah's Cylinder talk around ideas of noise and the politics of what is defined as noise versus sound, how that relates to the Victorian era, but then also talking about contemporary politics of noise and sound and policing. And it was such a rich conversation to hear coming out of this application of sound studies ideas to, say, Henry Mayhew in this particular era. And I was also curious, we hear this politics of noise come up from scholars like Jennifer Stover when we're thinking about the sonic color line and the racialized ways that sound is defined as noise in relation to identity. And so it should be, I would think, I mean, maybe I'm just so nerdy that I'm excited about it, quite fascinating to see how these kinds of identity politics unfold in Henry Mayhew's discussions of sounds and noise in this particular era.
Yeah, you're exactly right in your instincts about sort of where some of this may have come from. We talked about Stover. We read Sun Eidsheim's work on the Race of Sound. And that was a very important book, I think, for students in the seminar, as was Dylan Robinson's Hungry Listening, which was amazing. You know, the very first thing it does is take down R. Murray Schafer on this question of noise, right? Basically, his account of Inuit throat singing as kind of awful noise, right? And so the politics of what is called noise and what isn't called noise in relation to identity formations and identifications was much discussed throughout the seminar. And I think that Sarah was sort of bringing some of that back to the Victorian works that she's really interested in writing about.
Kind of got on the topic of bells earlier, and this next Cylinder talk that you've brought in for us brings up the idea of bells yet again.
Yeah, so this is a Cylinder talk by Aubrey Grant on Edgar Allan Poe's poem, The Bells. There is actually a very recent article in PMLA, which is sort of like one of the major literature journals of the Modern Language Association, on this poem that I assigned for the course. It was published just last year, 2020, so really very recent, by Peter Miller, called Prosody Media and the Poetry of Edgar Allan Poe.
Aubrey really dove into readings around prosody, which was sort of a new area to him. So thinking about literary prosody, so the sound in the printed word, right? That's one way to describe what prosody is. You know, these are things you learn in high school, assonance and consonance and rhyme, right? Those are ways of thinking about how sound functions in poetry off the page. But, you know, the combination of our course and his discovery of prosody and his already quite mature thinking around signification and theories of language resulted in kind of a mind-blowing reading of this poem, using language and signification techniques to communicate sound in ways that he argues are quite unique to Poe.
So here is Aubrey's talk titled Poe's Impossible Sound.
In a short story from 1919, Rilke describes his mysterious fascination with a skull he has brought home from an anatomy lesson, where once it contained, within its narrow confines, a brain and an unbounded self-consciousness, it now appeared to him as a hollow structure, an empty vessel. One evening as he passed it, flickering in candlelight, he was struck by the realization that he had seen the coronal suture once before. That jagged zigzag pattern of connective fibers that joins the front of the skull to the back was the very same pattern he had seen inscribed on an equally hollow wax cylinder when, as a child, he had listened to his own voice in all its sonic ephemerality, separated from his body for the very first time. What kind of sound would issue from the skull, Rilke wondered, if a phonograph needle were to trace the contours of the coronal suture? What primal sound would be produced if, rather than simply tracing the graphic inscription of a sound that already existed, the phonograph could play the as-yet unheard lines, grooves, cuts, and graphemes of nature itself. Setting aside speculation on whether the sound would be noise or music, Rilke's perspective is decisive. It is only by means of mechanisms, machines, and techniques that it becomes possible to listen, to really listen, to the unsounded sounds of the real. More broadly, the phonograph itself and its cylinder, of which this talk is a simulation, points to the fact that listening has always been a technique for intervening in the real. In this way, the phonograph is merely the technological exteriorization of a practice of signal processing with its own history, a history which revolves around the question of how we listen, that is, of the techniques we use to filter sounds out of noise to produce something that we can hear. In my essay, I argue that Edgar Allan Poe's The Bells articulates a transformation in listening techniques marked by a shift from a regime of signs to a regime of signal processing. Taking Friedrich Kittler's Media Technical A Priori as a starting point, I argue that Poe's poem is a kind of phonograph avant la lettre, which is both invested in print culture and sonically undermines it. Arguing along lines set out by Eliza Richards, Peter Miller, and Jerome McGann, I will begin by situating Poe's attention to the mechanics of prosody within 19th century print culture and industrial reproduction. In this reading, Poe's poems are prosodic machines that not only produce an infinite variety of performances, but are themselves technologically reproducible. In a manner analogous to Benjamin's analysis of cinema, it is the very reproducibility of the poetic machine that constructs the cultural modalities of listening in the mid-19th century. However, while holding on to this theory and historical context, I believe that a close reading of The Bells will reveal Poe's attention to a kind of listening that exceeds the boundaries set by written signs and human voices. My reading will center around the orally evocative deployment of onomatopoeia in the poem. Although Poe's use of onomatopoeia to emphasize themes and enhance the musicality of performance has been well documented, what has escaped notice is the fact that the word bells is not itself onomatopoeic. Rather, it is only through his use of repetition that it becomes so. Like a real bell's percussive clapper, which makes its hollow interior ring and resound, the repetition of this mechanical supplement empties the word of signification while retaining its acoustic qualities. What occurs, I argue, is that the graphic inscription becomes an empty vessel, like Rilke's skull, which channels uncoded frequencies of a primal sound concealed in the materiality of the letter. In other words, the noise of the real, an impossible, inhuman sound, that the signifier normally articulates into signs becomes audible for the first time in Poe's poem. From sign to signal, this sourceless, acousmatic sound may well be the music of the printed word's own dissolution into the noise of the coming phonographic age.
Yeah, talk about repetition.
Yes, exactly, exactly. So just a couple things. Yeah, the sound that I used in the back, I think we're all familiar with that. We listened to it actually at the beginning of the course. It's the ending segment of Alvin Lucier's I'm Sitting in a Room. The reason that I wanted to use that segment was because, you know, I had intended to actually base part of my thing on that, because what I was looking at was like, what is the sound that is sort of like hidden in the voice, and how is it revealed or made present through this kind of structure of like repetitive feedback looping, and how it dissolves articulation into pure noise.
Yeah, Michael.
I just thought that your cylinder was like very symbolically lovely. I think that you set up, I mean, obviously the background noise thing, it felt like someone turning a large wheel of music in some ways, when the wheel makes one revolution of the sound, the piston hits the thing. And the piston is obviously, from your presentation, the piston reminds me of like the mechanical aspect of the bell. And the sound reminds me of the individual trying to like capture this beautiful sonorous noise, just having them connected directly in one machine with no like feeling of humanity in between. And only the skull was a great image.
I love the Gothic media theory stuff. I mean, this stuff is great. Ultimately, Michael, that's sort of what I was aiming at. I wasn't thinking about it as much as a piston, although that works too. Thinking about the way in which like a record as it turns, or a cylinder as it turns, is a kind of cyclical repetition. And that repetition doesn't have to be just like a bell ringer, like a hammer banging and going like laterally, but is actually like a cyclical process. A
couple of things that came to mind, just thinking about the relationship between the sign and sound. So really, and the idea of being able to, in a sense, play something like a skull or something in nature. So basically how the sound reproduction technologies seem to evoke and suggest these new possibilities of turning any sign into sort of sonic content. And this is talked about in an article by Theodore Adorno called The Curve of the Needle. For him, piano rolls, right, were seen as that source of potential sound. His way of thinking about it, it's sound recording and sort of the bumps on a cylinder or a flat disc are still indexical to original things that made sounds that caused the air pressure to record them. But the piano roll, insofar as it was generating sound just from punched holes, suggests the possibility of creating sounds out of nothing, right, in a sense, or just out of random. It made me really think of digital processes. And so this link is to Patrick Feaster's work. And he, rather than talk about his work as about sound reproduction, he calls it eduction. To educe is to bring out, elicit, develop from a condition of latent, rudimentary, or merely potential existence. So the repetitious sound of your sound piece, in a way, is one of the base necessities for educing something, because it has to be moving and cyclical in order to generate a sense of continuous sound or sonic quality. So you can't just have sort of random symbols. There has to be some kind of ultimate pattern assigned. Just the concept of sonification, in a way, is one that it seems could be useful for you to be thinking about in relation to your project.
What are you hearing in listening back to this piece in the discussion, Jason?
Oh, it's funny. I think the first thing I said when it was done was talk about repetition, right? But what I was referring to there actually was a discussion we'd had about Poe's The Bells previously, which is a poem that is built on repetition, right? And as Aubrey points out, you know, one of the main things that's repeated is the word the bells. Like, so there are full lines of the poem that are just bells, 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 bells. So, you know, just to continue with your idea that really starting with what is not an overly respected poem, you know, Poe's piece, it was a recitation staple. It's seen, you know, often as not a very deep poem, very surfacey. And that's one of the points that interests Aubrey very much, actually. Discovering prosody, literary prosody, as a kind of field of technical discourse around the analysis of poetry, and then filtering it through some of these other disciplinary fields, like media history in particular, that was extremely productive and generative for him. And I think having to engage in this sound piece exercise also expanded his way of thinking. I mean, I don't really know, but I'm not sure that he would have taken his thinking as far as he did if he hadn't had to go through the process of actually making a sound work himself.
I do have quite an appreciation for this poem. I think because it was one of the poems that I had to read in high school very in depth. And I think we took turns reading it aloud in the class, you know, these kinds of things. But at the time, I hadn't really been thinking about the ways in which Poe is really very thoughtful in thinking about the different textures and materials and the different actual soundings of these different bells. As we were listening to this, I had to pull up the poem again to jog my memory about some of the descriptive language that he's using and some of the, again, prosody and techniques that we might think about and the ways that he's describing silver bells and golden bells and brazen bells and iron bells. So I think this is really a great poem to go to, almost as one of the starter texts you can think about in applying sound studies concepts and techniques to poetry and to poetry readings.
I think that's right. And I think what Aubrey and the discussions we had in this seminar did for my thinking about the poem was to move it out of sort of the elocutionary realm, which is where I would normally sort of stay in thinking about this poem, because like I said, it was a recitation manual staple in the 19th century, which means that people would find it in these parlor recitation books that they would do for their own amusement at home, right? And this was one of the poems that they would, you know, readily read. And there were tons of parodies of the poem as well, because it does lend itself to that, right? But it was a kind of staple piece for the performance, the demonstration of virtuosity in elocutionary performance, an ability to, in a sense, sound the poem and do justice to the various qualities, tonal qualities of the different metals, for example, that you mentioned. How do you do that with your voice? You know, so you could think of it as if it were a song, you know, in the 1990s, it would be a great piece for like Celine Dion to perform, right? Because it would really allow her to show off her voice in all of its virtuosity. But I think moving it into the realm of thinking about it from the point of view of signification and of media, as Aubrey really pursued it, like you say, made this poem a kind of obvious staple for a literature/sound studies course.
That's definitely a cover that I would love to hear. Celine Dion doing a sung version of
the bells, yeah.
Both the bells. But talking about covers, that actually brings us perfectly to the final cylinder talk that you've brought for us to listen to today.
This piece is done by Andrew Whiteman. So Andrew, among all the students in the seminar, has the most training in using sound recording media. He's a professional musician and has been for the last 20 years. And so, you know, he didn't attend my workshop on Audacity because he knows how to work with digital audio workstations and make sound. But also, he's very interested in engaging in doing sound pieces that involve poetry. So he has a whole art practice that's around this. Anyways, he sort of fell upon finally a topic that seemed like it would be a good one to pursue. And essentially, it boils down to the question of, does the idea of the cover, we talk about cover songs, can we talk about cover poems or the idea of the poet's cover, as he phrases it? And so because he was interested in oral poetry, let's say, the Odyssey, like Homer, Homeric, you know, bardic poetry. He started thinking about opening canto of Pound's Cantos, which is kind of a cover of a short section of the Odyssey, and then pointed him to Penn Sound's archive, where there are recordings of Pound reading that opening canto one, as well as some other poets reading portions of it. And so he had a sort of mini archive that he could work with that brought in his interest in bardic poetry, sort of oral poetic forms, which are formulaic forms. So we can't think of doing a cover in the same sense, because the poem changes every time a bard, you know, re-performs it, versus the question of someone reading the printed, already sort of fixed version of a poem differently, you know, and thinking about that as a kind of cover. And so he focused on Robert Duncan's sort of lecture on Pound, in which he performs Canto One.
Here is Andrew Whiteman with the poetic cover.
When I went to the library here, I discovered something about this intellectual community, and that is that its total interest in Mr. Ezra Pound seems to have faded. My initiation in the count as one is like. So he's not on the reading list. But how did I come to hear of it?
Killed breakers forth from the godly sea, and we set up mast and sail on that swart ship, bore sheep aboard her, and our bodies also heavy with weeping.
I found myself in the august and terrifying presence of a Lady Bluestocking, who knew the entire modern scene, which made her vastly superior to the entire
Aphrodite,
and in one fell swoop, I was initiated to the mysteries of the sky, trembling and running to the bookstore, Ezra Pound, on Telegraph Avenue, Elliot, and the and found there the 30 cantos, what was then the avant-garde.
It's all very confused domain of something one might call voice, which in Pound one doesn't know whether voice is sort of actual or metaphorical, especially.
And I opened the page and read, and then went down to the ship. I can't bear it. I'm like, this is too much. For a whole week, I went around
and then went down to the ship. It set keel to breakers forth on the godly sea, and we set up mast and sail on that swart ship.
Well, what do you do when you read a poem? How do you find the rhythm of a poem that is not written? You go da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-
of youths and of the old who had borne much.
Most people can't find a river.
Souls stained with the recent tears, girls tender, men many mauled with bronze lance heads.
1 pound's recordings were released.
But actually,
we all found out something we could not know when we were reading the 30s, the 40s, and so forth. And that is that pound and tone, and if you hear the record, you will find he has a contour of a sort of singing intoning to the line. And then went down to the ship, set keel to breakers forth on the godly sea, and we set up mast and set.
Battle spoil bearing yet dreary arms. These many crowded about me with shouting men, many mauled with bronze lance heads.
Our American trouble with men, many. I mean, already difficult enough when you get that many in there. Men, many mauled with bronze land, and so the. So I don't always find the most elegant reading.
Hess's husband is a Brit, sort of says, well, sounds like, you know, you never got out from under the impress of Yeats or something like that. And Pound is really hurt and leaves the room and takes his, you know, and the next day reads in a completely different fashion. Much more relaxed, much more conversational. And you have the two readings there.
Took it to heart.
By making them overlap so that the thing plays a double role. Now,
Took it to heart. It's really interesting. The first high Yeatsian reading and then the next much more kind of casual and infinitely superior reading. It's really interesting.
Right. And where did you find this thing?
She sent them to me.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, they have
if
not
you
been
don't
hurt
find
since,
me,
you know, they
you
made
have
them back in 59 for a German rape.
I wonder if other stuff will start to surface.
Well, I'm hoping. Yeah.
If you don't find the music, you have not found the elegant solution.
Yeah, Aaron.
I found this an incredibly potent and effective way to tackle Pound's enormous influence. I mean, he's kind of like, when it comes to modern contemporary poetry, he's like the Wizard of Oz, you know, behind the screen. He's just everywhere. And so the way you made him disappear into his progeny, his voice kind of being subsumed under Duncan's and the like, I found it very, very effective.
That was Aaron Obedkoff.
We always get this image of Pound, Aaron, as you're saying, as the Wizard of Oz. But in that talk where Olga's husband, who's British, who says, oh, well, gee, you really can't get away from Yeats, can you? It's like, oh, my God, the ghost, like whether you find him this horrible, you know, fascist monster or whether you find him in whatever way, he looms so big. And this is like a little, it pricks the bubble in this image of poor Pound going away with his book and then coming back the next day and changing his reading style. But what's interesting is we don't know, like the sound of Pound that we have there where he's like this, is that him toned down? Like there's a whole question there. Was he even worse before? Like was he even more before? We don't know.
I'm really interested in the way you use space panning and also accelerating to differentiate between sort of continuing Aaron's observation about where Pound's voice was in the mix of his after Pound era, the way where you were using it as a way to actually make your arguments. You know, if you want to talk a little bit about like whether there was much intentionality or whether you were just going with what sounded good. But I also like the way you took the Filaris conversation, the talk, you know, which is like one contemporary manifestation of continuing to engage with these recordings, the effect of speeding it up almost highlighted its gossipy nature or sort of relegated it to a less important discursive register that actually accelerating suggests belittling or something like that.
Yeah, I think you're Dr. Freuding me really well now because, and also trying to make them talk to each other, that's probably the big thing. I like trying to make different eras talk to one another where they don't belong. And so where Duncan says, I was in the Augustan presence of Lady Bluestocking, like whoever that is, someone who initiated him. He uses the word initiate three times, which I put in there because he places himself in vis-a-vis Pound, you know, in a religious place. And so when he says the Augustan presence of Lady Bluestocking, you know, I have Pound say Aphrodite, golden girdle or whatever, to just try and emphasize Duncan's position as a initiate. And then that is what my paper is about, how Duncan says the exact same words that Pound says, but his cover of Canto One is completely different and signifies in a completely different way.
This one has, it's just so rich. It really is more of a soundscape composition. And this really does show the range that your students brought to the table when they were thinking about the idea of a cylinder talk, where here we have Andrew's cylinder talk that doesn't have his voice in it at all. It's really engaging with the archive and engaging with these ideas of covers and covers almost as layers of sound layers on top of each other through time, through space, through these different contexts that he's grappling with in these different poetic covers. Tell me a bit about listening back. What's coming forward for you?
Yeah, I've been thinking more, like, as you were just saying, about what a cover is, because I think one of the things that his cylinder talk does so successfully is exactly what he said he was going for, which is communicate the ways in which the same sort of text can not only sound differently, you know, but also through that sound represent an entirely different worldview, literally worldview. So ideology in relation to the world, but also sort of literary worldview, meaning what literature and what talking about literature and what performing literature is supposed to be accomplishing. He layers them for us to sort of understand that we can only partially see or know the meaning of what a sounding of a poem would mean in a particular historical context. That's one of the things that I hear in this piece.
Yeah, I mean, every time I listen to this, I feel like I'm hearing something else. And it could just be me projecting, but I feel like we are experiencing a bit of Andrew's personal experience of grappling with these archival sounds. We get this sort of disorientation in listening to the harsh panning back and forth in the first half of the cylinder talk there. And then we also have this comedic moment with the speeding up of the voices, which again could be, I mean, for me, evokes the feeling of the monotony and maybe the hilarity that ensues after listening to hours and hours and hours of archival tape in real time, right? Because it sounds, yeah. You have to listen and you have to digitize in real time and it can make you a bit loopy.
Well, yeah, I think that's what he was referring to when he said I was Dr. Freuding him. Like, I think he was sort of, the point he was making is that you can hear his own himself in the positioning that he gives to the sounds in the piece, that he's also positioning them in relation to how he feels about what he's doing right now.
Inviting students to engage in audio production, one of my hopes and what I think sound does really well is opening up the doors to allow students to grapple with and experience and describe and share their own embodied experience of engaging with these ideas outside of the very traditional essay writing format that we get ingrained with, you know, in high school and then carries forward into their undergrads and haunts us later in our academic careers as well.
That's really true. And I think, you know, we've heard some of that through the various comments in response to all of the cylinder talks that we listened to. It's somewhat different from the formulae of knowledge production that they're used to engaging in.
And so I think that's very quickly associated with putting themselves out there a little bit more, right? That there's more of themselves in the decisions they're making, because the decisions haven't been sort of pre-made for them as, you know, as to what an essay is supposed to be or what, you know, this kind of knowledge production is supposed to have in it. And then also, as you point out, that it is a very embodied experience because it involves listening. It involves bodily fatigue, because that work can really take a long time when you're sitting at the computer doing the sound editing. And then it makes me think also about sort of the relevance of calling this a cylinder talk assignment rather than a podcasting assignment, because no one knows what a cylinder talk is, right? You know, it's sort of a made up idea as a constraint. And I add some, and we did have discussions like, say, well, what is a cylinder talk, so that they knew what they could sort of engage in. But people have ideas about what a podcast is already. So in some ways, a podcasting assignment would allow them to lean a little bit more on models than an assignment where they have to do a cylinder talk, where there really aren't any precedents for this. In retrospect, I think that was a productive aspect of the assignment, was that there wasn't even a kind of sonic generic precedent that they could rely upon.
Yeah, thinking about the cylinder as a container.
Yeah.
A very simple constraint that has a very material aspect to it as well. Versus, I think if we thought about podcasting more in that way, we might start to create some more interesting things.
Yeah, possibly.
I was curious, listening through some of the cylinder talks that your students made, how you see this kind of assignment being applied to other courses that you teach, or maybe in the future, other disciplines as well.
I guess it all starts with an exercise in the use of constraints to generate really interesting creative solutions. The cylinder talk, it's a cipher or an empty container in a lot of ways, and yet a very restrictive constraint simultaneously, right? The idea of having assignments of constraint and maybe of unfamiliar constraint could be extremely productive across the disciplines. I mean, this seminar was really about engaging with theories of listening from many different disciplines and then thinking about our own discipline from the respective of those readings. But I think the sound assignment was getting at that question and problem and goal in a different way, in a much more practice and sort of embodied way.
Yeah, thinking about the different ways that we can approach our pedagogy, what other assignments can we bring in to kind of shake students awake a little bit? So I guess at this point, now it's my turn to go and listen back through the discussion that we just had.
Yeah, sorry, we talked too much.
Yeah, we should put out an extended cut.
Yeah, exactly.
This has been a pleasure listening to some of the work that your students put out, because, you know, that this is one of the frustrations always, is both as a student and as an instructor, students create these wonderful works and only everyone in the course gets to hear it and no one else. So I'm glad we got to share some of these out in the world for others to enjoy as well.
Spoken Web is a monthly podcast produced by the Spoken Web team as part of distributing the audio collected from and created using Canadian Literary Archival Recordings found at universities across Canada. Our producers this month are Spoken Web team members Stacey Copeland of Simon Fraser University and Jason Camelot of Concordia University. Our podcast project manager and supervising producer is Stacey Copeland, and our assistant producer and outreach manager is Judy Burr. A special thanks to Alexandra Sweeney, Aubrey Grant, Sarah Adams, Andrew Whiteman, and all the students of English 604, Literary Listening as Cultural Technique, for their cylinder talks and discursive contributions to this episode. To find out more about Spoken Web, visit spokenweb.ca and subscribe to the Spoken Web podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you may listen. If you love us, let us know. Rate us and leave a comment on Apple Podcasts, or say hi on our social media at Spoken Web Canada. From all of us at Spoken Web, be kind to yourselves and one another out there. And we'll see you back here next month for another episode of the Spoken Web Podcast, stories about how literature sounds.